Greetings, everyone, and welcome to this Orinoco Tribune interview. Joining myself and Dana from Orinoco Tribune today, we have Pitasana Shanmugathas, co-director of the excellent documentary film series Truth to the Powerless, an investigation into Canada's foreign policy. We're going to speak a bit about the film itself and about Canada's foreign policy today. Pitasana has a master's degree in global affairs from the University of Toronto's Monk School of Global Affairs and has worked in multiple organizations advocating for peace and disarmament, such as Save the Children, Science for Peace, Canadian Voice of Women for Peace, and Stand Canada. While completing his postgraduate education at the University of Toronto, Pitasana decided to embark on a three-year documentary journey starting in 2019 to explore Canada's foreign policy. I wanted to ask you first, Pitta, about your inspiration for making this series of documentary films. What motivated you to do that in the first place?
Yeah, and thank you for having me, first of all, to speak about my docuseries. It's a long story. Initially, when I was going to school, you kind of learn about Canada as being this peacekeeping nation, you know, that Lester B. Pearson, you know, Canada's former prime minister, you know, he had intervened in the Suez crisis and really introduced peacekeeping to the world. And so we're very benevolent. And that's kind of the education that you get. And you kind of get criticism about Canada's policies with respect to Indigenous people. You're taught that in school now, which is nice, but I don't think it goes far enough. But that's, as far as criticism, that's kind of where it ends, really. So that was what I was taught in school. It wasn't until I stumbled upon a work by a writer by the name of Eve Zengler, and he had written an article about Lester B. Pearson. I was sitting in the airport and I just was just going through my social media feed. I stumbled upon this article by Eve Zengler, and it was about Lester B. Pearson, about how he had supported the Vietnam War and how, you know, he had been a key ally in forming the State of Israel, and, you know, been supportive of dispossessing Palestinians. So this was like a revelation, and that kind of began this journey, you know, of me just going through Eve Engler's work. I then, you know, came upon the Black Book of Canadian Foreign Policy, which just kind of blew my mind open. And that was my first critical exposure to Canada's foreign policy in a very, you know, anti-militaristic light, which kind of exposed Canada's horrendous atrocities. The idea to actually do a documentary would come years later. I stumbled upon a documentary called The Sellout of East Timor, and it was done by a filmmaker by the name of Elaine Briere, and it was released in 1996. And this was like the first, as far as I know, the first Canadian foreign policy documentary that really looked at Canada's, an element of Canada's foreign policy in a critical light, in a critical anti-militarist light. And then I came across another documentary by a filmmaker by the name of Amy Miller, and it was called Myths for Profit. And it also looked at Canada's foreign policy in a more broader scope, in a very anti-militaristic light. So I looked at these two documentaries, and these two documentaries were anti-militarist, but they were only interviewing activists and dissidents of Canada's foreign policy. They weren't really interviewing, they never interviewed the politicians responsible for formulating and advocating and championing and executing Canada's foreign policy. So it was at that moment that I thought, hey, wouldn't it be a cool idea if there was like a documentary that interviewed the politicians responsible for formulating Canada's foreign policy and executing and championing it, as well as the activists and dissidents that are challenging that foreign policy. So you would get both sides of the picture. That's when the idea first came to me. I'd become friends with a filmmaker by the name of Ryan Ellis, who had been in the film industry for quite some time. And one day he just asked me, you know, do you have any ideas like to do like any sort of film or project or like documentary? And I was like, yeah, I kind of have this idea about, you know, doing a documentary on Canada's foreign policy. So I pitched it to him, and then this was in 2019, in April of 2019. And then from there, we just, just began interviewing academics and activists and politicians. So that's where the journey kind of began.
Great. Dana's going to ask you in a bit a few questions about Canada pertaining particularly to their relationship with apartheid Israel. First, I wanted to ask you what your experience has been since you made the film in terms of promoting it. And I think maybe particularly considering the algorithms on social media and the fact, you know, that you're promoting a film that is critical of Canada's foreign policy. What kind of avenues have you seen opened or closed to you because of the contents of your film?
The mainstream Canadian media has just totally ignored this. My project partner Ryan, he was friends with a journalist at the CBC who had actually expressed an interest in our, you know, he watched our docuseries and he loved it, and he wrote an article to, and he submitted it for review at the CBC to be published, and then they refused to publish it, and they didn't give any reason as to why. So that's just one instance of the case where the mainstream media just kind of ignored our docuseries. And so that's that, and it's not surprising because we challenge, we're critical of Canada's, the mainstream media in our docuseries and the way that they shape, Canada's foreign policy, the narrative behind that and how they justify intervention. So that's not surprising. We've also, we've received a lot of support from peace organizations. Our film was screened by the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute. A lot of activists have been sharing our docuseries. So we've received a lot of support there. And really social media has been our friend in this regard through promoting on, you know, Facebook and Twitter and all these, peace groups are promoting it on their email networks. And so in that sense, social media has been our friend in that regard.
Very nice. Thank you. I would like to thank you for your docuseries. I mean, being someone who was born in Canada and living abroad, Canada definitely has this like reputation or kind of this image of like being like, yeah, like a peacekeeping nation or whatever you want to call it. So I think it's really important that we challenge this narrative, and your documentary can definitely do that. So something that I'm kind of watching really closely and something that we're watching from Orinoco in general is what's happening with the apartheid Israel. And so I wanted to ask you how you think that Canada's relationship with the Zionist state today compares to its relationship with South Africa towards the end of its apartheid regime. So you mentioned how in 1986, Canada imposes sanctions on the apartheid South African regime. And what do you think it would take for Canada to impose sanctions like that, or to even stop or impede the sale of arms to them? And also comparing Justin Trudeau to Brian Mulroney, it seems Mulroney was much more willing to take a stand against apartheid, even though he belonged to a more conservative government. Do you think this is reflective of the Liberal Party in general, or of Canada's position as a global power on the whole? And lastly, I don't know if you can speak to this, but if there's any like progress or effort you're seeing in any Canadian political parties that are willing to take a stance, like a more harsh stance against apartheid Israel.
Yeah, so I'll kind of answer the last question first. With respect to some progress that Canadian political parties have made, the most noticeable progress has kind of been the NDP under Jagmeet Singh, where we discussed this in our docuseries, actually, that for the first time in like Canadian history, the NDP, the leader of the NDP, called out Justin Trudeau in Parliament and said, you know, you need to halt arms sales to Israel so long as it continues its illegal occupation, its settlement building activities. So that was a significant, shift, because prior to this, and Jagmeet Singh has put out like a policy outline of this is where the NDP stands. We condemn Israel's settlement activities. We need to halt arms sales to Israel, and he's put out a more substantive, a hard line. Previously, like when he had first became leader, he was a fairly staunch supporter of Israel. Like, he would have to be bombarded by activists, you know, outside, you know, Palestinian activists to say you need to call out the state of Israel. And, you know, just leading up, you know, until Israel's, you know, fairly recent assaults, you know, he's been a strong supporter of Israel. So this was like a significant shift. So that's probably the most noticeable change of a Canadian political party really, you know, speaking out against Israel. But that came, you know, there's like a huge, like, years and years of history behind Jagmeet Singh, the NDP party shift on this issue. You know, that took years and years of at the NDP headquarters convention trying to put resolutions which were, you know, for some reason or other, like, rejected, or they wouldn't be tabled. So that took a long time for this to finally happen, and he's getting a lot of pushback. But for the most part, Jagmeet Singh is holding his ground for the most part, as far as I know. In terms of South Africa and Brian Mulroney, that kind of came as a result of like years and years of organized resistance on the part of Canadians that were targeting, you know, South African businesses, that were targeting Canadian businesses that were doing investment in South Africa, exploiting the black labor force, the cheap black labor force in South Africa. So like the organized opposition in that case was so strong, and you had seen a pattern of our neighbor in the U.S., our neighbor in the United States, was they had organized, mobilized resistance where across the spectrum in the United States society, black and white people were rallying and calling for the West to impose sanctions, strong sanctions, compelling the apartheid government to release Nelson Mandela and really bring democracy to South Africa. Even when Brian Mulroney imposed sanctions on South Africa, the sanctions were actually far less strong than the sanctions that the United States and other European countries imposed. For instance, we still maintain like diplomatic relations with South Africa. We still did $1 billion in trade with South Africa after we had imposed the sanctions. So like our sanctions were far weaker than the United States sanctions against South Africa, which were very strong because you had like the Congressional Black Caucus, you had all these huge black leaders that were really pressing the United States government to take a hard stance against South Africa. And Ronald Reagan was a racist who was opposed strongly to sanctions against South Africa. And he had to, his veto like was overridden by both chambers of Congress. In the case of Israel, in the case of South Africa, we can make the comparison that South Africa they needed their cheap black labor force because that was like an economic engine. In the case of Israel, the Palestinians are completely useless to them. They just would prefer that they kind of just disappear. And that's like the main contrast, where in the case of apartheid South Africa, the cheap black labor force was a useful economic engine where foreign companies would invest to exploit this black labor force. That's not the case in Israel, where it's the Palestinians are kind of just a nuisance there and they just need to be gotten rid of from the perspective of Israel. In both cases, the reason why Canada supported apartheid Israel and the reason why Canada supported apartheid South Africa is because they're settler colonial nations that were premised on suppressing, subjugating, getting rid of the indigenous population. And Canada was built and founded on suppressing the indigenous population, expelling the indigenous population. In fact, in the case of South Africa, we discussed this in the docuseries, South African officials came to Canada and looked at our residential schools as a model that they can emulate in the way that they govern their apartheid structure in South Africa. In the case of how we can actually build resistance to finally compel Justin Trudeau to impose sanctions on Israel to halt arms sales, that will have to result in even greater mobilization, even greater pressure from the Canadian public. You know, in the case of Israel, Israel uses this tool of anti-Semitism. Anytime you have a leader that kind of, you know, comes up, we saw this with Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party, just baseless criticisms of anti-Semitism. We're kind of seeing it with Jagmeet Singh a little bit. And so they use that as an effective, a potent tool to stifle any criticism of Israel's actions. So I think it just has to result in a fever pitch of mobilized opposition within Canada to the point where Canadian political leaders across the spectrum would just have to say, okay, this situation is untenable. We can no longer support Israel's occupation. And you know, Israel is now increasingly going in even more hard right direction with Prime Minister Netanyahu's re-election and the coalition that he'll have to form. You know, so it's really tough to say what will happen.
That's great. As our viewers know, Orinoco Tribune is a Caracas-based English language media outlet. Each of the six parts of the documentary is on a different topic: South Africa, Israel, and there's one that speaks about Latin America and Haiti specifically. I wanted to maybe you could provide a little bit of a background on Canada's foreign policy towards Venezuela. A lot of viewers might not be aware of that, and maybe you could speak just a little bit about the really topical events in terms of the newly elected governments that were formerly part of the Lima Group, which has been described as being a Canada-led operation to overthrow the democratically elected government of Nicolas Maduro.
Yeah, so the Lima Group is kind of premised on creating a peaceful resolution to the economic crisis in Venezuela. That's like the premise of the Lima Group, but really it's just like a cover to oust Nicolas Maduro from power, painted in like flowery language. So Canada has been at the forefront of trying to, you know, of backing up Juan Guaido to replace Nicolas Maduro as the leader of Venezuela. Canada has held several meetings, you know, bringing all these Latin American countries, you know, like Chile, for example. But it's become largely a failure. Canada hasn't been successful. And the reason why Canada is backing Juan Guaido is because Canada wants a Venezuela that will be more receptive to like mining interests. There'll be more receptive to Canadian and other Western-led companies exploiting Venezuela for its resources. And Nicolas Maduro is opposed to that. And Canada's opposition to Venezuela, you know, it dates back to Hugo Chavez, the Canadian establishment just branded as a dictator and a thug. And even though he had enormous popularity among the people, and once Venezuela had encountered its economic crisis, which was, you know, supported and backed by the West through sanctions, Canada has imposed sanctions on Venezuela. Canada has, within the Lima Group, has sought to refer Venezuela to the International Criminal Court to face, under Maduro, charges for its alleged human rights abuses. So Canada's very much, you know, exploited and is responsible partly for Venezuela's economic troubles. And, you know, Venezuela, Hugo Chavez had also made a mistake in the sense that he didn't diversify Venezuela's economic resources. I think Venezuela was too dependent on oil, and that really hurt them. So when Nicolas Maduro came in and, you know, the global markets weren't that favorable, it resulted in a climate and an atmosphere which was supported by U.S. led sanctions that really hurt Venezuela. But, you know, many countries have, Peru has now expressed opposition to the Lima Group. So, you know, it's the Lima Group without the Lima in it. So many other countries have since, you know, we see now with Brazil is we have Lula coming back, you know, in countries like, you know, Bolivia, in countries like we have left-wing governments that are kind of coming back. People are saying it could be like a resurgence of like a pink tide. I don't know, but I don't think they're going to be successful. And now with the crisis in Russia intervening in Ukraine, you know, and how that's affected European oil supplies, and a lot of people are kind of looking towards Venezuela. And you know, there was a recent meeting between Nicolas Maduro and Emmanuel Macron, where Emmanuel Macron kind of expressed interest of, you know, we need to repair our relationship, and that may have been a very, you know, strategic move, perhaps, of trying to get Nicolas Maduro to bring oil to Europe because of these Western U.S.-led sanctions against Russia. So, well, you know, I think it's been largely a failure. I don't, you know, and yes.
Yeah, that's a great summary. Thanks. I wanted to ask you also about Canada's role in Haiti, where they played a large role in I believe it was the 2004 overthrow of democratically elected President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, and also Canada's role in the core group. Haiti's been in the news a lot lately, obviously. With the possibility of a renewed military intervention by the U.S. as they're trying to get international support for that, what is Canada's role in these current events regarding Haiti?
Yes, our docuseries looks at Canada's involvement in Haiti in overthrowing, dismantling democracy there. So we interview the politicians that were responsible for the 2004 intervention in Haiti. We interview the foreign affairs minister, the defense minister. You know, we interview the U.S. on the U.S. side. We interview we interview Lawrence Wilkerson, who was the chief of staff to U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell. And so we get the establishment narrative, and we also get the narrative from activists and the Haitian dissidents. So in that case, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, he was a democratically elected, he was a Catholic priest. He had a strong resonance among the poor people of Haiti. He wanted to uplift Haiti so that it could become a dignified, you know, it could become a country that was dignified to a degree, you know, poverty with dignity. That was kind of like a slogan that Jean-Bertrand Aristide and his party, the La Balasse party, kind of embodied. They just wanted to improve the living standards of the Haitian people, increase the minimum wage. Under Aristide, when he was president, they had increased the minimum wage. They had significantly tackled the HIV/AIDS epidemic in the country. They had dismantled the ruthless Haitian military, which was organized and trained and set up by the United States, and that was causing horrendous atrocities. They had, you know, there were more schools built during the La Balasse administration than any other time in Haitian history, really. So they were doing all of these initiatives that were really strongly supporting the poor people of Haiti. And this was creating a sense of animosity within the US and within Canada. In the case of Canada, Canada is the largest blank t-shirt making company in the world, Gildan Activewear. They're in Haiti, and when Aristide increased the minimum wage in Haiti, this was strongly opposed by Canadian business interests. The real threat was that it's the threat of the net of a bad example. If a poor, impoverished country like Haiti can improve its standard of living and can give health care to its people, give education to its people, that then threatens other countries that are subservient to U.S. interests, Mexico and Honduras and all these other countries. So it then creates a potential domino effect. So that was the real reason behind the fact that Aristide had to be overthrown. And what was probably another trigger to that reason of why Aristide had to be overthrown is because he was calling for France, Haiti's former colonial occupier, to pay reparations to Haiti, because what France did was in exchange for Haiti becoming free, the first Black republic, first free Black-led republic in the world, France said, you have to pay us back for the slaves that we're going to lose. In essence, the Haitians had to pay for their freedom. And Aristide had calculated the amount of debt which Haiti had paid, which had severely bankrupted its economy. Aristide had calculated several billions of dollars. And while Aristide was president, he said that, France, you have to pay back our debt so we can invest it in our people and so that we can become a flourishing country. And France was opposed to it. So that was kind of the trigger. And now there have been a new